Folk songs in American history. The South. The South has played a leading role in the history of our country for centuries. Besides contributing such giants to the political scene as George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, the South has a rich and colorful heritage. Since the founding of the first colony at Jamestown, Virginia, untold millions of people have come to America seeking refuge from religious persecution. Many of the newly arrived immigrants broke all ties with their European homeland, including their churches. In America, many of them joined frontier churches such as this one. In these churches, they created a new type of religious song, music quite unlike the old traditional church hymns. This music brought folk tunes into the church. It was a more personal kind of song, reflecting the feeling of the people. The next song, The Poor Wayfaring Stranger, is an example of it.
I'm just a poor wayfaring stranger, a-traveling through this world of woe. But there's no sickness, toil, or trouble in that bright world to which I go. I'm going there to see my father. I'm going there no more to roam. I'm just a going over Jordan. I'm just a going over.
In 1619, the first Negroes were captured on the west coast of Africa and brought to America. Faced with a life of bondage and hopelessness, the Negro thought and sang of a better life that awaited him in heaven. Out of this grew the famous folk music we call Negro spirituals. Many of the Negro spirituals are based on Bible stories. This next song, Joshua Fit the Battle of Jericho, is one of them. This music is unique and is an important contribution to folk music in America.
That morning, Joshua fit the Battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Joshua fit the Battle of Jericho, and the walls came tumbling down. Joshua fit the Battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Joshua fit the Battle of Jericho, and the walls came tumbling down. Now good morning, Brother Pilgrim.
Yes.
Pray tell me, where you bound?
Uh-huh.
Well, I'm traveling through this wilderness, over this enchanted ground. My name is Tillamore Pilgrim.
Yes.
To Canaan I am bound.
Uh-huh.
Well, I'm traveling through this wilderness, over this enchanted ground. That morning, Joshua fit the Battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Joshua fit the Battle of Jericho, and the walls came tumbling down. Now you may talk about your king of Gideon,
yes.
You may talk about your man of Saul,
uh-huh.
But there's none like the good old Joshua at the Battle of Jericho. Up to the walls of Jericho, he marched with the spear in his hand. Go below them, a lamb ram, Joshua cried, called the battle lamb in my hand. Now when the lamb ram sheep horns began to blow and the trumpets began to sound, oh, Joshua commanded the tune to shout, and the walls came tumbling down. That morning, Joshua fit the Battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Joshua fit the Battle of Jericho, and the walls came tumbling down. Now there's no man like Joshua, there's no man like Saul. Now there's no man like Joshua at the Battle of Jericho. I say there's no man like Joshua, there's no man like Saul. Now there's no man like Joshua at the Battle of Jericho. Now when the lamb ram sheep trombones began to blow and the trumpets began to sound. Old Joshua commanded the children to shout and the walls came tumbling down. That morning, just for the battle of Jericho, 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 just for the battle of Jericho, and the walls came tumbling down. Up to the walls of Jericho he marched with spear in his hand. Go below them, lamb ram, Joshua cried, called the battle lamb in my hand. Now when the lamb ram sheep horns began to grow and the trumpets began to sound, old Joshua commanded the children to shout and the walls came tumbling down. He said, shout, children, shout. He said, shout, children, shout. He said, shout, children, shout. And the walls came a-tumbling down.
Mothers the world over have been lulling their babies to sleep for centuries with soft, gentle songs. These are called lullabies. It is a song to calm and soothe a child, and almost always the baby is told to go to sleep. This southern lullaby, All the Pretty Little Horses, has been a favorite of both white and Negro families on plantations and in cities. It promises the child pretty little horses when he wakes up.
Hush-a-bye, don't you cry. Go to sleep, little baby. When you wake, you shall have all the pretty little horses, blacks and bays, dapples and grays, coach and six little horses. Hush-a-bye, don't you cry. Go to sleepy little baby. Way down yonder, down in the meadow, there's a poor little lambie. The bees and the butterflies pecking at its eyes. The poor little thing crying, mammy. Hush-a-bye, don't you cry. Go to sleep, little baby. When you wake, you shall have all the pretty little horses. Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Around the turn of the century, this yellowish-black bug, only a quarter of an inch long, caused great problems in the South. It is the boll weevil and came from Mexico. The boll weevil lived on the cotton plant. Wherever it went, millions of acres of cotton fields were destroyed. Cotton was finally saved from the damages of the weevil with the use of a chemical insecticide. Folktales pictured the wandering little weevil as looking for a home. The Negro was also looking for a home. He too was far from his native land and had no place to call his own. Listen to the next song and see if you think the boll weevil finds a home.
Have you heard the latest? Latest of the song about that little boll weevil. He done been here and gone, looking for a home, looking for a home. A boll weevil, he's a little black bug from Mexico, they say. Came all the way to Texas, looking for a place to stay, looking for a home. Just looking for a home, 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 a looking for a home, just a looking for a home. Well, the farmer took the boll weevil, he put him in a cake of ice. The boll weevil said to the farmer, this is mighty cool and nice. This'll be my home, this'll be my home. Now the farmer took the boll weevil and put him in the hot sand. Boll weevil said, this is mighty hot, but I'll stand it like a man. It'll be my home, it'll be my home, home, home. It'll be my home, it'll be my home. The boll weevil said to the farmer, you better leave me alone. I ate all your cotton, now I'm gonna start in on your corn. I'm a-looking for a home, I'm a-looking for a home, home, home. Looking for a home, I'm a-looking for a home. The farmer said to his missus, what do you think of that? Boll weevil's gone, ate a hole in my best Sunday hat. He's looking for a home, he's looking for a home. Now if anyone should ask you, who was it made this song? Tell him a poor old farmer, he done been here and gone. Ain't got no home, ain't got no home. Ain't got no home, ain't got no home.
At one time in our history, the minstrel show was the most important form of entertainment in the United States. It consisted of white men blackening their faces and imitating the singing and dancing of Negroes. Its popularity lasted for over 70 years, until the 1900s. It began with E.D. Rice, a young actor, who stopped on a street in 1828 to watch a Negro singing and dancing. Rice thoroughly enjoyed what he saw and heard. He started an act imitating the Negro, and thus the minstrel show was born. One of the most famous of all minstrel tunes is Old Dan Tucker.
Dan Tucker's a fine old man, washed his face in a frying pan, combed his hair with a wagon wheel, died with a toothache in his heel. Get out the way, old Dan Tucker, you're too late to get your supper. Get out the way, old Dan Tucker, you're too late to get your supper. Tucker's come to town, riding the billy goat, leading the hound. The hound dog barked, the billy goat jumped, landed old Tucker on top of a stump. Get out the way, old Dan Tucker, you're too late to get to your supper. Get out the way, old Dan Tucker, you're too late to get to your supper. Now Dan Tucker's come to town, swinging the ladies round and round, first to the right and then to the left and then to the gal that he loves best. Get out the way, old Dan Tucker, you're too late to get your supper. Get out the way, old Dan Tucker, you're too late to get your supper. Get out the way, old Dan Tucker, you're too late to get your supper. Get out the way, old Dan Tucker, you're too late to get your supper.
Goal, and she is, we may say, eminently successful in attaining it. For her method of hurting Jason is to kill her two children, whom she loves deeply, but who are the only objects besides himself in the pursuit of power which Jason cares anything about. It is a grim and terrifying scene in which Medea decides upon the murder of her children in a fit of mental torment and hesitation. But when she realizes that this is the only way she can make Jason feel the bitterness of her own emotional hurt, she represses her qualms and carries out the act. Thus, Medea accomplishes the central goal of her existential situation, but her action is tragic rather than heroic because of the terrible and unwilling price she must pay to achieve her purpose. Let us now summarize the salient features of the three tragic heroes we've discussed as a group. Each of the tragic heroes is characterized by the fact that he undertakes critical and decisive action, a total commitment to achieve a goal that his own will, intelligence, or spirit demands that he strive for at the cost, if necessary, of his life. In Prometheus's case, it was a sense of what was just which led him to defy Zeus at all costs. In Oedipus' case, it was his religious faith and human dignity which impelled him to attempt to avoid committing the crimes of parricide and incest by making every possible effort. And in Medea's case, it was the importance of love to her status and dignity as a human being which drove her to the only act that could assuage the grief she felt. In each case, we see that the hero totally commits himself by an act of personal will to a significant goal for which he stands ready to sacrifice even life itself. In each case, a powerful struggle is initiated by the hero, which ends in a tragic denouement because the hero, either like Oedipus, is struggling against forces which by their very nature cannot be overcome, or like Prometheus and Medea, accomplishes the desired goal, but only at a terrible cost. When we turn now to a study of the dominant trends in American literature during the 20th century, we find that the most significant symbolic literary heroes show radically different traits than those we have discussed from Greek literature. Because I can only discuss a limited number of them, and because I'm now venturing into a field in which I'm not a specialist, I think it is important that I cite some specific criticism in the field of American literature to justify the selection of literary figures that I have made and the interpretation of their existential situations that I shall present in this discussion. In an essay written shortly after the Second World War entitled Henry James and the Artist in America, W.H. Auden wrote as follows of the American literary scene. Coming from Europe, my first, my strongest, my most abiding impression is that no body of literature written at any time or in any place is so uniformly depressing. It is a source of continual astonishment to me that the nation which has the worldwide reputation of being the most optimistic, the most gregarious, and the freest on earth should see itself through the eyes of its most sensitive members as a society of helpless victims, shady characters, and displaced persons. And I cannot escape the conclusion that the sudden popularity of American literature in Europe is a function of the latter's disintegration. I am helpless, I am shady, I am displaced, she says. And here is a literature which describes my condition in a way that my own authors have not. But it is not of homelessness or of crime that I wish to speak. In these respects, I believe American literature to have given a uniquely accurate picture, but of the denial of free will and moral responsibility, because this is a recent feature. It is not conspicuous in the great classical American writers, but has become so in the work of the past 30 years. It is only lately that in novel after novel one encounters heroes without honor or history, heroes who succumb so monotonously to temptation that they cannot truly be said to be tempted at all, heroes who, even if they are successful in a worldly sense, remain nevertheless but the passive recipients of good fortune, heroes whose sole moral virtue is a stoic endurance of pain and disaster. Similar views have been expressed by a number of other critics, and the figures whom I shall now be discussing bear witness in favor of the general interpretation of the character of contemporary American literature made by critics such as Auden, Faulkner, and others. I begin my study of American literary heroes with a discussion of T.S. Eliot's J. Alfred Prufrock. Let us see how Prufrock's existential situation illustrates a dominant strain of thought that runs through American literature in the 20th century. The core of his situation centers about his desire to ask a question concerned with love of a woman whose possible indifference so frightens him that he relapses into a weak and faltering silence. Let us watch how his fear and indecision develop as he thinks of the woman and the question he wishes to ask. And indeed, there will be time to wonder, do I dare, and do I dare? Time to turn back and descend the stair with a bald spot in the middle of my hair. They will say how his hair is growing thin. My morning coat, my collar mounting firmly to the chin, my necktie rich and modest, but asserted by a simple pin. They will say, but how his arms and legs are thin. Do I dare disturb the universe? In a minute there is time for decisions and revisions which a minute will reverse. And so on through several stanzas of doubt and fear and questioning to the culmination of his own and summation of his own personality. No, I am not Prince Hamlet, nor was meant to be. I'm an intendant lord, one that will do to swell a progress, start a scene or two, advise the prince. No doubt an easy tool, deferential, glad to be of use, politic, cautious and meticulous, full of high sentence, but a bit obtuse, at times indeed almost ridiculous, almost at times the fool. What characterizes Prufrock's approach to existence is fear, doubt, and a sense of his own insignificance. He differs fundamentally from the tragic heroes we have discussed in that he does not initiate any action toward a goal that he has himself chosen, but rather remains a passive, this is the root meaning of the Greek word from which the term pathos comes, passive sufferer of external events. Also, unlike the tragic heroes, he undertakes no total commitment in defiance of what hurts or restricts him in his environment, but rather accepts his condition as given and unchangeable, and spends his life, as far as the poem tells us of it, merely in lamenting his existential situation. Prufrock can survive, but only in a secondary capacity, and the pain and the hurt of striving for what he wants more than anything else in the world, to ask his overwhelming question, are so great that after some wrestling with himself, he gives up the attempt and accepts a role in which such struggles of conscience, aspiration, and spirit are repressed. As such, he is our first example of the pathetic mode of literary hero, who suffers rather than acts, and who accepts rather than strives. The second contemporary literary hero that I wish to discuss is Frederick Henry in Hemingway's Farewell to Arms. The first part of this novel presents some highly effective narration of war scenes culminating in the near shooting of Henry as an infiltrator and his consequent desertion from the Italian army. However, the core of his existential situation concerns his love affair with Catherine Barclay, and it is this aspect of the story with which I wish to concern myself. Shortly after his desertion from the Italian army, Henry meets Catherine and Stresa prior to their flight to Switzerland. His reflection on the nature of human existence is very important here, since at this point we might reasonably expect him, although somewhat discouraged and a little frightened, to be nevertheless hopeful about the new life that he and Catherine are about to embark upon. I now quote Henry's thoughts at this early point in the development of his existential situation. We could feel alone when we were together, alone against the others. It has happened to me like that only once. I have been alone while I was with many girls, and that is the way that you can be most lonely. But we were never lonely and never afraid when we were together. I know that the night is not the same as the day, that all things are different, that the things of the night cannot be explained in the day because they do not then exist. The night can be a dreadful time for lonely people once their loneliness has started. But with Catherine, there was almost no difference in the night, except that it was an even better time. If people bring so much courage to this world, the world has to kill them to break them. So, of course, it kills them. The world breaks everyone, and afterward many are strong at the broken places. But those that will not break, it kills. It kills the very good, and the very gentle, and the very brave, impartially. If you are none of these, you can be sure it will kill you too, but there will be no special hurry. A mood of bitter cynicism invests Henry's remarks here, and the clear implication is that a hostile and evil nature pervades the world, depriving human existence of all positive meaning. We can see that under these circumstances, the only role open to man is that of passive sufferer in a world situation that inevitably and inexorably seeks and attains his destruction. Let us now see how this theme is developed in an ever-increasing crescendo of restatements. When Catherine is going through a protracted and difficult childbirth in Switzerland, Henry muses to himself, "Poor, poor dear cat, and this was the price you paid for sleeping together. This was the end of the trap. This was what people got for loving each other. And what if she should die? She won't die. She can't die. Yes, but what if she should die? She can't, I tell you. Don't be a fool. It's just a bad time. It's just nature giving her hell." Here, perhaps, we have a phrase that might well serve as the existential leitmotif of the entire work. It's just nature giving her hell. This is the grim interpretation of the meaning of human existence as it emerges from the events depicted in this novel. Under these circumstances, there is no point to human striving, to the heroic total commitment of a tragic hero. There is only meaning in the pathetic mode of life. I would like now to turn to two final literary figures who will sustain the picture of the pathetic hero that has been drawn through Prufrock and Frederick Henry. The central core of the existential situation of Blanche DuBois, the heroine of Tennessee Williams' A Streetcar Named Desire, is the striving for a sense of human dignity based on the capacity to give and to receive love, which the events of her life have frustrated and crushed. Anyone familiar with the play knows how ruthlessly the superficial facade of her gentility and the hypocrisy of her protest of virtue are torn away by the unrelentingly brutal glare of truth. When she arrives at the Kowalski home in the first scene, her disguise of gentility and virtue is already undermined by her obvious alcoholism. And in the course of the action, we learn that her visit has really been occasioned by a no longer tolerable promiscuity which has driven her from her home. However, throughout the play, we are conscious of her sincere and deeply expressed desire for the dignity that the giving and receiving of love would confer upon her, and also of her incapacity to attain this goal because of what she has become as a person since she faced and failed to solve the most crucial existential problem in her life. This event, which was the determining factor in all that has since happened to her, concerns her discovery of her husband's homosexuality and her driving him to suicide, after which she says in regard to her own life, "And then the searchlight which had been turned on the world was turned off again, and never for one moment since has there been any light that's stronger than this kitchen candle." Her life from that point on begins the long descent which characterizes her present existential situation, a terrifying search for love against the background of constant intimacy with death. The vision of love that haunts her is a mocking contradiction to the reality of her existence. When the possibility of marriage with Mitch appears promising and he has told her, "You need somebody and I need somebody too, could it be you and me, Blanche?" she replies in what may be the deepest and most moving passage she speaks, "Sometimes there's God," so quickly. Later in a passage we have quoted, she speaks again of her need of someone like Mitch, someone who was gentle, a cleft in the rock of the world where she could hide in. Mitch, however, has learned too much about Blanche to care about her loneliness or needs, and even the little candle which has lighted Blanche's life up to now is about to go out. Blanche's situation then has resulted from the failure to meet the critical existential problem of her life successfully and her subsequent attempt to escape from the reality of her situation through alcohol and promiscuity until she reaches the point of no return and on the verge of insanity is forcibly removed from the society in which she has failed to find her place. Her life is characterized by the desperate but impossible attempt to forget and to flee from the misery, loneliness, and pathos of her existential situation. The last of the contemporary figures that I shall deal with is Willie Loman in Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman. The core of Willie Loman's situation is his aspiration to succeed both materially and as a husband and a father. The confusion which takes place in his mind between these two goals and the priority that is to be ascribed to each, and the resultant tension that develops between his aspirations and his performances. Let us study the evidence for Willie's situation as he himself presents it to us. In a flashback scene to Willie's prime as a salesman, we find his wife Linda asking him how well he did on his trip. His first response adds up to 1,200 gross and a huge commission, but on closer questioning by his wife is reduced to a very modest 200 gross. The need to be a success, well-liked and prosperous, are values already so implanted in Willie's outlook that he is forced to exaggerate the all too mediocre achievements of his best days. In this scene, Willie sees the reality of his situation in a flash of insight when he tells Linda, "You know, the trouble is, Linda, people don't seem to take to me. They seem to laugh at me." His failure to be the success in material terms that he wishes to be leads to annoying loneliness and frustration that demands some release. He tells Linda, "'Cause I get so lonely, especially when business is bad and there's nobody to talk to. I get the feeling that I'll never sell anything again, that I won't make a living for you or a business for the boys. There's so much I want to make for." The feeling of loneliness, the direct consequence of his failure to achieve the image of success he has set for himself, drives him to a relationship with a secretary he has met in one of the stores to which he sells. And this relationship sets the stage for an overwhelming defeat in his life. The crucial scene which portrays this defeat takes place when Willie's son Biff, hurrying from New York to enlist the aid of the father he idolizes and getting out of a scrape at school, finds his father and the woman together in a hotel room, and in bitter anguish, from that moment and forever, abandons himself and his father. As Biff perceives the situation and cries out in humiliation and pain, Willie fumblingly tries to reassure and console him. To this attempt, Biff replies by bitterly mocking his father as a liar and fake. Thus does Willie Loman's failure to achieve material success lead him to a situation which destroys his relationship with his son. Willie reacts to this with ever-growing fantasies that rearrange and distort the unbearable facts of his existence. Like all heroes of the pathetic mode of literature, Willie Loman lacks the strength to act decisively against the forces that oppress him and becomes a passive sufferer of a hostile fate from which he can only attempt to flee along the narrowing paths of the imagination until the only route of escape open is self-annihilation. We have now discussed three modes of life and literature, the heroic, the tragic, and the pathetic. We saw that the heroic pictured man is active and successful in meeting the challenge posed by his environment. The tragic pictured man is vigorously struggling against the challenge posed by his environment and either failing to succeed in this struggle or paying an excessive price for success. And the pathetic pictured man is a passive sufferer, either accepting failure or attempting ineffectively to escape from the reality of his existential situation. In the literature of 20th century America, we have found the pathetic mode to be dominant. Yet we may observe a significant undercurrent of rebellion against pathos and toward tragedy on the part of a number of significant writers of our own day. Thus, Auden remarks in the article previously quoted that a novelist should depict human life in this way, as lacking free will and moral responsibility, is in the strictest sense comic. For since writing a book, like playing baseball, is a totally unnecessary act, it could not be undertaken by a man who is lacking in free will. So that a novelist who describes man as the absolute victim of circumstance and incapable of choice contradicts his assertion by the mere fact that he has written a novel. If we agree with Auden's rejection of the pathetic world view, then we must ask the question, as difficult to answer as it is important to raise, as to how we may bring about the resurgence of tragedy as the dominant literary genre in the circumstances of contemporary American life. In this regard, I cannot speak with